The new stand boasts an array of titles that bring rich texture and vibrant colour to their coverage of craft, whether we're talking ceramics or textiles. We hear from the editors at two titles that are both perfectly formed and fit for purpose today on The Stack. From Midori House in London, this is The Stack, 30 minutes of print industry analysis, with me, Tom Edwards. This week, we look at two titles, one dedicated to the world of ceramics, the second a magazine that's the leader in the field of fabrics. Oh yes, we're definitely getting a bit crafty this week on the programme. Let's start with the founder of renowned textile magazine, Selvage, Polly Leonard. Welcome to The Stack. Great to have you with us. Thanks
Thank
for coming
you
to see
very
us.
Much.
And thanks indeed for, well, for all the editions of Selvage, but particularly the most recent one, which a little sound effect there, issue 81, which is looking in particular at various aspects of Japanese sort of textiles design, Japanese denim, and there's some absolutely wonderful stuff in there which we'll come on to, but it's been entertaining me a great deal recently. But maybe let's start with a bit of a stock take on where Selvage is at. 15 years.
Yep,
I confronted you with the reality of 15 years a moment ago. A stupid question in a way, but what's the evolution been like? What's the story been like from a pretty modest beginnings to now, you know, the magazine of record for your sector in a way?
Yes, I don't plan too far in advance, I have to say. I take each day as it comes and get very excited about the next issue, but don't particularly make long-term goals. Which the advantage of that is that it has kind of twisted and turned throughout the decade and a half that we've existed. The magazine has stayed constant. Selvage as a brand has moved into various different fields, which keeps it interesting for me, I think.
But I guess a lot of people say, well, hang on, that's obviously great, but surely there must be strategic sort of elements to the process that change. But when something takes on a scale, I mean, I don't know, your readership is in the many tens of thousands, 70-odd
yes,
thousand.
Yeah,
I mean, this is too big and too scalable an enterprise to run on whims, for example.
Yes, but, yes.
So how do you sort of marry up those challenges with that same almost, improvisational quality, I guess?
So the thing that I think is possibly, one of the things that is interesting about Selvage is that our readership are truly worldwide. And that only exists partly because of the point in time in which I launched the magazine, that the internet was just big enough to reach that worldwide readership quickly enough for us to financially sustain ourselves. So bearing in mind we have readers in Canada and India and Stockholm, we have to vary the content. So we do themed issues. We've done a couple of Indian issues, and we did one last year at Christmas about Iceland. So this issue is Japan. We work seasonally, so we tend to look at linen in the spring and we look at wool in the autumn. And those things come round and round again. And textiles, I suppose, like fashion, has cycles. We're having a big renaissance in the textile industry at the moment, particularly in the UK. So we've had lots of stories about mills that have taken their production offshore and brought it back to Yorkshire. So I suppose that's how we keep a very widely geographically dispersed readership happy.
And these are such good narratives, so many of them. And they're very much, actually, they're things that we're interested in at Monica as well. I guess maybe that's why so much of the agenda chimes with me. Just to that point about digital, when you mentioned the internet there, it struck me again, looking at this recent issue, there's a beautiful spread here looking at sort of different textile map, if you like, of Japan. And that's the kind of thing you might see rendered on a website, you know, 10 things you need to blah, blah, blah. But there's something indefinably more charming and alluring about looking at it and presented as you have it here in a beautifully drawn map, and then these lovely little samples on a page, almost like a swatch of fabrics. Are you still very much, and I assume I know the answer to this, but in that idea that, you know, the printed magazine can do something that nothing else can still?
I mean, I trained as a designer, not as a journalist. So I have this idea that Selvage is about inspiration, not aspiration. So my thought is that you can tear out any page from any issue and it can inspire a weave design, a print design. Maybe it's just an idea about a birthday cake you're going to decorate for a cousin, or can be the seed that plants in one of our readers' imagination that takes them off on a different journey.
And that's interesting. I think you may be, Polly, the first magazine founder or editor that I've ever spoken to who is essentially actively encouraging people to tear up their beautifully crafted products. And I suppose that is interesting, because that does take me to this idea of you as a, you know, a manipulator, a crafter of textiles, as well as of great publishing. Can you tell us a bit about your background and your practice, I suppose, in textiles, and maybe how that influences not just these ideas about being altruistic, saying, let's tear this out and use it as an expression, but maybe the way that you work more broadly on the magazine?
So I trained as a weaver. I went to Glasgow School of Art. I did embroidery and weaving. I then went to the US, did a master's degree in fibre art. I made baskets and sculptures. So I'm very, very much a maker. But there was never a magazine, you know, going back 20 years, that satisfied my curiosity. So there are magazines like Vogue that tell you what's happening on the catwalks. And there were lots and lots, and still are, of, dare I say this, not particularly well-produced magazines for amateur organisations. The Embroiderers Guild, the Spinners, Weavers and Dyers, etc., etc. So with Selvage, I very much wanted to give textiles the respect I thought it deserved. Mm. I wanted good writing, which when I launched the magazine didn't really exist. I wanted people to write about textiles in the same way they write about painting or the industry or whatever. And I wanted it to be visually beautiful, every page to be divinely beautiful.
So what's the sort of newsstand ecology as you see it? Or do you genuinely not think about that, Polly? I wonder, does it sit in your mind alongside, say, I don't know, a World of Interiors, which obviously looks at textiles in part alongside of its other content? Or are you always just committed to this idea of Selvage being, you know, in a group of one almost?
Yes. I don't chase sales, which might be arrogant or might be its little bit of genius. We sell on the newsstand, but I tend not to think too much about that, because can you ever get that right? Is it not just second guessing? I think if I produce a magazine with a cover that I find arresting, the image stays with me, then perhaps that's going to be the same for other people. And that's the best you can do.
Well, indeed. And so I guess then that talks more about, you mentioned your loyal international readership. Presumably, therefore, you know, the subscription sort of side of things is important. What about the relationships with your readers? Is it very immediate? Do you have a sort of open door policy? Do people come to see you? Are you always in correspondence? How does that work? Because obviously that's one, presumably, of the great elements, the relationship of you with your reader that has contributed to this long-running success.
We are, although we're quite a large business these days, I still answer the telephone. I still correspond with readers around the world on a daily basis. And often the ideas for the issues, although they're thematic, will come from a conversation. I had a conversation with the lady from South Africa who'd been to see an exhibition of beads. So that's kind of interesting. Could you write about it? She sent me some text and some images. And maybe that put together with several other things that I will link with writers I already have a relationship with, will then form the body of another issue, perhaps at some point in the future.
You're listening to The Stack on Monocle 24. We'll have more from Polly Leonard and more besides after this.
Just grow like a tree with the roots very deep on earth.
For the best in food and hospitality, tune into the menu.
I learned that from a potato farmer way up in northern Maine. And he baked me a potato and it was like eating the best thing ever.
Monocle's programme on food and drink introduces you to the most inspirational chefs, dedicated producers and innovative restaurateurs.
Some cinnamon syrup, a half an ounce of that. Got our Bosca Schnapps, an ounce of this.
So when you need inspiration for your dinner plans or want to find a new place for a superb cocktail, tune into The Menu with me, Marcus Hippie, premiering every Friday at 1900 London time.
It was really the River Cafe where I really just had a deep relationship with carrots. vegetables. Sorry, I said carrots, but I love carrots. So I meant vegetables in general.
Monocle's stately March installment comes with a decided South Korean flavour. We sit down with President Moon Jae-in to talk Trump, troublesome neighbours, and taking the time to watch TV with his cat, no less. Plus, we dedicate a 48-page survey to an in-depth look at South Korea through the chefs, artists, entrepreneurs, and designers shaping it. Elsewhere, we profile the key players searching for positive solutions in Jerusalem, meet the sharp minds making a point in the pencil industry, and augur the year ahead in art from New York, London, and Hong Kong. In the design pages, we mark the rise of timber towers from France to the US and bed down in the bedazzling dorms of a Copenhagen college that has us mulling over the merits of heading back to school. All before a breeze around the world's biggest outerwear fair, ISPO in Munich. And we chew over Paris's freshest new food shop. Monocle's March issue is out now and available on all good newsstands or by subscription.
You're listening to The Stack on Monocle 24. Let's talk about another title, and actually, well, you can stay with us and listen to this too. Ceramic Review, which bills itself as the international magazine for ceramics, ceramic art and pottery. It too has an ambitious scope. The universe of ceramics is vast, encompassing weekend hobbyists and cutting-edge contemporary visual artists alike. So how does that magazine serve those diverse enthusiasts? Well, Monocle's Henry Rees-Sheridan spoke to the title's assistant editor, Isabella Smith. Let's have a listen.
So we're the international magazine for ceramics, ceramic art and pottery. We're bi-monthly. We've been going since 1970. And we're owned by the Craft Potters Association, which is a membership organisation for pottery professionals. We present the latest news, views, reviews on ceramics. It's a resource for ceramic artists, potters, anyone with an interest, academics, hobbyists, you name it, we cater for them.
So it's quite a broad kind of reader base, or potential reader base, as you describe it. And, you know, just thinking about ceramics before this interview, it strikes me that they occupy a bit of a weird position between kind of homely crafts and high contemporary art. How do you kind of straddle that gamut of ceramics?
Yeah, well, you've put your finger on a real issue that we have to think about every single time the magazine comes out, which is how do we cater for this diverse audience, as you put it. We try and cover as much of the world of pottery right through to contemporary art based with clay, not necessarily even fired, so raw clay, as it's called, which means that one issue can span everything from a contemporary art installation made with clay that's designed to disintegrate over time, or it can go right down to traditional country pottery. So as you see, we've got our work cut out in order to straddle these two, well, more than two, multiple worlds, which occasionally can cause some friction among our readership, as people who've been reading the magazine for nearly 50 years sometimes bridle at the kind of contemporary art side of things. But we think this push and pull of ideas is really healthy. We think it's really productive. So it's something that we're really keen to promote in our magazine.
Talk me through the latest issue to kind of illustrate how you get that mixture of flavours. I'm looking at it in front of me, the latest issue. I'm very pleased to see it's got a stack of the iconic Brown Betty teapots on the front cover. Tell me a little bit about the cover story.
That's a story about, as you say, the Brown Betty teapot, which we all know and love from our nan's kitchen table. It's been redesigned by, well, I say redesigned, it's been revitalised, let's say, by a man called Ian McIntyre, who has gone back into the history of this 300-year-old design icon, just had a look at what its really strong points are, what makes it such an icon of design, and really tried to pull together those key elements into a revitalised product, essentially. So that cover story is about a history of design and a history of design improvement with a much-loved cultural icon. A totally different angle is how to make a teapot. You can see there's something of a theme emerging here. So we've asked the potter, Ruth Ann Tudball, to talk us through, show us step-by-step how she makes these very distinctive soda-glazed hand-thrown teapots, which she throws on something called a momentum wheel, which means that you kick it with your foot rather than, you know, having an electric motor do all the work for you. It's an ancient Japanese tradition, and she's put a contemporary spin on it. So for all of you who've started an evening class or you're inspired to try something new, this is the kind of thing that we offer as a place to start. And then alongside that, we've got a profile with a up-and-coming ceramic artist called Lauren Naumann, who was the winner of something called the Newcomer to Ceramic Art London 2017 Award, which is something we present yearly at Ceramic Art London, which, as your readers may know, happens at Central St Martin's once a year. It's put on by the Craft Potters Association, which owns the magazine, so we work closely with them as the media partner. Lauren's really interesting because she's invented this extremely innovative process of slip casting, which means pouring liquid porcelain into a mould that she's modified this technique to create these kind of wire-like sculptures, I would call them, although they take the form of a vessel. So they look like vases, but you could never pour anything into them, say, because they're completely net-like. And then they kind of twist and deform in the kiln, and it's a pretty interesting process. So a year on from winning that prize, we caught up with Lauren and had a chat with her about where her career is taking her, how she does what she does, and so on. Even just from those three examples, you can get a sense of how varied it is, what we cover, how much of a broad church we aim to be. There's glaze recipes, there's clay tips, there's reviews of the latest pottery shows, ceramic art shows, there's opinion pieces, there's a bit of something for everyone.
So I'm interested in hearing more about the Craft Potters Association, which is the organisation which owns, right, the magazine.
Yeah, it's the parent organisation, yeah.
Okay, what is that organisation and what's its relationship to the magazine in terms of business structure? I'm interested in hearing about, like, like the ads you carry in the magazine, how it makes money, is it subsidised through any other operations?
The Craft Potters Association, or CPA, is a long-running membership organisation. It was established in 1958, and it's a national body representing ceramic artists in the UK. So it aims to encourage the making of studio pottery and foster and extend the interests of those who make it. So providing networks of communication, of distribution, and so on, for those who work within the craft. The CPA puts on events like Ceramic Art London, Ceramic Art York, Ceramic Art Oxford, which are yearly selling fairs. It owns the Contemporary Ceramic Centre, which is just opposite the British Museum in London, and it owns Ceramic Review. The CPA is actually celebrating its 60th anniversary this year. We've got a touring programme called Discover Ceramics, which is starting this September, which will be going to six major museums across the UK, including the British Museum and the Ashmolean. Essentially, each of its branches supports the work of the others. So some of the profit from the gallery goes into the magazine and vice versa, with the fluctuations of how well either are doing. You know, we run adverts for CPA events. We try and support CPA members alongside maintaining a good editorial balance across the board. So we do maintain editorial distinction between our CPA-related output and everything else, in order for it to not become a totally biased publication. It does aim to be the kind of representative publication for across the pottery world.
One of the most important factors fueling, I think, the uptick in visibility of kind of crafts and design in recent years is social media, and particularly visual social media like Instagram. I imagine that ceramics is no exception in that regard. What do you think a physical magazine like Ceramic Review can offer that a decent Instagram account can't?
I think it has plenty to offer that a decent Instagram account can't. So, for instance, there's always the joy of a paper product, as your readers well know, which is something that we get as feedback fairly often. We occasionally hear from people who've got every issue from 1970 onwards that they've lovingly stored in their pottery workshops.
That
or wherever,
is a dedicated readership.
Which is very dedicated. We're very lucky to have a readership who's so invested in what we do. They refer back to them. It's full of authoritative voices, which won't necessarily be the case with an Instagram account. So we try and get curators, specialists, makers, and so on, who are really well qualified to talk on these subjects to contribute to the magazine, whereas on an Instagram account, you know, anyone with a smartphone can have their say, which, you know, has its good and bad sides. But this is certainly an area where we try and get authoritative voices. It's a beautiful magazine. People like to have it on their coffee tables. They like to refer back to them. They like to have them out. We're proud to have a readership which we think is in excess of 18,000, and we think that that's because people like to share it. It's a product that people like to hold on to. They like to pass them on to friends, family members, colleagues. We often have colleges where copies are passed around to upwards of a dozen people.
Isabella Smith, assistant editor at Ceramic Review, talking to Henry Rees Sheridan. And Polly, you're still with us. Looking at Selvage, it's interesting that point about the collectability of magazines. Now, to my mind, Selvage is it does have a sort of bookish quality. I know you would like me to rip the pages out for design inspiration. But do you have sort of inveterate collectors and hoarders?
I do.
That must be interesting to hear from them, I guess.
I do, very much so. And in the early days, we reprinted several issues, but there are just too many at this point now. Issue 80, 82 we're putting together. So I have many correspondence with readers who are desperate for issue 47 or whatever. And can they find it on eBay or you know, wherever? Do we have any tucked away?
But you have to leave them wanting more, right? That's part of the mastery.
Yeah.
Now, we also heard in that chat that Henry was having with Isabella there about the contributors, and you've already talked a little bit about your sort of dialogues ongoing. Is there a typical contributor to Selvage?
Yes, I have lots of academics. Now, academics are great; they're super knowledgeable. But I do have to train them to, you know, Selvage is not an academic journal. It needs to be accessible. So we have to encourage them to write in a journalistic style. Mm. So the content has to be accurate and, you know, scrupulously accurate, but it has to be presented in an accessible way.
And is that a question of, you know, the editor, the arbiter, wielding the traditional red pen, which I'm sure you have. There's no real shortcuts to that, is there, in the process?
No. Lots of backwards and forwards. Lots of what do you mean by this? Yeah.
And they take that positively? Some academics that I've met in my time, Polly, I may be not the most receptive.
We're fairly clear about what we want right from the beginning. And we're just kind of insistent.
I think this is good. This is good editing practice right there.
You know, I have been involved in textiles for 25 years. If I can't understand something on the first reading, it doesn't go in.
Very, very good. And you see, this is what social media can't do.
Yes.
See, exhaustive reads and rereads.
Yeah.
Now, you mentioned that 82 is in train, and we'll talk about that in a second. But looking back to 81, which is very beautiful and I have here, what's the sort of process? How does it work in terms of the composition? Obviously, it's richly illustrated. There's a great mix of photography, which is in these sort of big four-leaf images or drawings and all the rest of it. Is it a question, do you and your colleagues, I don't know, do you have a sort of big board and you run through ideas and just take some things for a walk and see where it leads you? Are you very clear, we need this number of components? What's that process like from issue to issue?
So this one was slightly unusual in that it began by the logo for the Japanese Olympic Games being designed, and it's indigo. So the Japanese Export Trade Organization, who we've worked with previously, invited us to go on a trip to Tokushima to look at indigo production there. So last October, I went to Tokushima for 2 weeks, and we looked at indigo production, and we went to a denim factory. So that was the core of this issue. Then, actually, is Japan really blue or maybe it's red? So we then had an article about the significance of red within the Japanese culture. Every issue we have a house story. We look at a travel feature. This time we have the map you mentioned earlier. We also need a Japanese artist. We have a couple of artists in this issue. Someone who is American, Roland Ricketts, who's worked extensively with indigo dye and elements of Japanese culture, but also a Japanese artist, Naomi Kayabashi, who works with Japanese paper. We've looked at ideas of an old Japanese traditional technique, shibori, and how that has been kind of adapted and remodeled as tie-dye in the West, and how that whole kind of conflict between a very traditional technique and a very throwaway craft
Well, and that's really interesting. I was going to ask you about this idea of conflict, and I guess we alluded to it when we were talking about ceramic review earlier, you know, the very classic and then the sort of the contemporary. If we look at textiles, you know, there is a boom, particularly in this country, in, you know, the doer and maker, the amateur. Is it a broad church where all are welcome, Polly, in your view? It strikes me as interesting because obviously these are narratives that, you know, if we look at, you know, the big business of fashion, people are much more interested in provenance and responsible sourcing of their materials and all these kind of things. Is it something where everyone can and should be more engaged from the sort of the amateur to the you know, the big commercial outfit?
I think making things makes people feel good. If they can make something and they can sell it on Etsy, fantastic. However, that's not quite the same as someone who has devoted a decade or 1,000 hours, 10,000 hours to become an expert. That's two different things. The confusion comes, I think, within the English language in that we only have one word, craft, which spans that huge divide. All things are not created equal, and all things would not find a place in Selvedge magazine. That's not to say we don't respect everything, but we strive for excellence, yet we value all the stages in between.
Let's cast an eye towards the future. Can you whet our appetites with issue 82? Any little learnings for what we might have to look forward to?
Well, we have wedding fever, of course, for May. We're very excited about lace. But of course, Selvedge, we're not looking at lace in a traditional way. We have an article about lace structures used in architecture and in fine art. So maybe you'll just have to wait and see.
So watch this space. And what about more broadly? We started off by talking about the evolution, I suppose, of Selvedge as a brand. Mm-hmm. And I don't know if you're one of those people that's loath to describe it as such.
No.
But what about where these things go in the future? I mean, do you have other components that you are considering? Do you get pressure from, I don't know, commercial partners or people who are interested in saying, oh, you know what you should do is X, Y, and Z? Do you welcome those narratives? And may we see things like that in the future?
We do. We look at everything. We're approached very frequently, and some we accept and some we reject. We, until pretty recently, had a retail store. We have just closed that down because we started to do workshops. You mentioned a great interest in craft. Those workshops took off and became larger than the space could accommodate. So we're now looking for a new space where we can do more extensive workshops. We do some in the south of France, which are great fun. But we're always looking, you know, we're very enterprising. We're always looking for new avenues.
There you go. So if that piques your interest, get in touch. And you know now that Polly will pick up the phone herself because she confessed that to us earlier. Polly, and it's been absolutely terrific to speak with you. Polly's the founder of the renowned Selvedge magazine. Make their stories part of your story. I second that. Polly, thank you very much for coming to see us.
Thank you very much. It's been a pleasure.
And that is it for this week's programme. Thanks to our producer, Fernando Augusto Pacheco, and our editors, Cassie Galpin and George McDonough. Comments or queries are welcome as always. Drop Fernando a perfectly crafted email at fp@monocle.com. And don't forget to join us at the very same time next week. This is The Stack. I'm Tom Edwards. Thank you very much for listening.